Chapter 2. The Revision and Reenchantment of Psychology. Legacy from a Half-Century of Consciousness Research. Part 2.
Working in a darkened room, lit only by weak red light, which makes it impossible to differentiate colors, and listening to Antonio Vivaldi's music, Louise painted 26 impressive large paintings in the style of Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec, Pablo Picasso, Amadeo Modigliani, Claude Monet, Rembrandt von Rijn, and other famous artists, all in the course of 1 hour. He painted most of them without looking, once while painting simultaneously with both hands, and one upside down with his bare feet under the table. Both stories are described in detail in my book, When the Impossible Happens. Raymond Moody, American psychologist whose international bestseller, Life After Life, inspired the field of thanatology, provided another piece of controversial evidence to the issue of the survival of consciousness after death. In his book Reunions, Visionary Encounters with Departed Loved Ones, Moody described a psychomantium, an environment that supposedly facilitated contact between survivors and their deceased friends and relatives. Moody reported instances in which the apparitions not only appeared in the mirror, but also occasionally emerged from the mirror and freely moved about the room as three-dimensional holographic images. A fascinating and truly incredible development in the attempts to communicate with the spirits of discarnate people is interdimensional transcommunication, ITC, an approach which involves modern electronic technology. This research could easily be dismissed as outrageous and ridiculous if it were not for the fact that it has been conducted under rigorously controlled conditions by an international group of serious researchers, including Ernest Senkowski, George Meek, Mark Macy, Scott Rogo, Raymond Bayless, and others. They reported that they were able to receive messages from the dead through instrumental means, appearing as anomalous voices and images on message machines, computers, radios, and TV monitors. This research also attracted the attention of senior scientists at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS. Interestingly, Thomas Alva Edison is alleged to have worked for many years on a machine that could communicate with the spirit world. However, Edison died in 1931 before he had a chance to publish any of his notes. Irvin Laszlo showed, through his thoughtful analysis of the data related to the problem of the origin and nature of consciousness, that neither the turbine theory nor the information field theory modeled by the computer network can adequately account for the observed facts. His conclusion was that the consciousness we experience as a stream of sensations, feelings, intuitions, and volitions is an integral part of the consciousness that pervades the cosmos. There is only one consciousness in the universe, and the consciousness that appears in us is an integral part of it. After decades of clinical work, C.G. Jung came to a similar conclusion. The psyche is not a product of the brain and is not located within the skull. It is part of the generative, creative principle of the cosmos, of the unus mundus. Materialistic scientists have not been able to produce any convincing evidence that consciousness is a product of the neurophysiological processes in the brain. They have been able to maintain this conviction only by ignoring, misinterpreting, and even ridiculing a vast body of observations indicating that consciousness can exist and function independently of the body and of the physical senses. This evidence comes from parapsychology, field anthropology, LSD research, experiential psychotherapy, thanatology, and the study of spontaneously occurring holotropic states of consciousness. Spiritual emergencies. All these disciplines have amassed impressive data, which clearly demonstrates that human consciousness operates in a way that lies far beyond the capacity of the brain, as it is understood by mainstream science, and that it is a primary and irreducible aspect of existence, an equal partner of matter, or possibly superordinate to it. In his groundbreaking book, The Tao of Physics, Fritjof Capra demonstrated that after 300 years of intensive research, Western science reached an understanding of the world of matter, quantum relativistic physics, that bore striking similarity with the worldview which the ancient Indian sages foresaw millennia ago in their meditations. A few decades later, psychedelic therapy, transpersonal psychology, and other avenues of modern consciousness research came to the same conclusion in regard to our understanding of consciousness and the human psyche. A new cartography of the human psyche. As above, so below. In the late 1950s, when I took my psychedelic research from the laboratory to my clinical practice, I was equipped with the knowledge instilled in me by my medical study, traditional psychiatric training, and Freudian psychoanalysis. This turned out to be very inadequate preparation for understanding the LSD experiences of my patients, as well as my own, and dealing with the situations that arose in psychedelic sessions. When I started conducting serial sessions with medium dosages of LSD with my psychiatric patients, many of their early experiences seemed to involve the territory I was familiar with, postnatal biography, and the Freudian individual unconscious. However, sooner or later, each of them moved into an entirely new experiential realm, which was at the time unknown to me. I was witnessing intense emotional and physical experiences of my patients that were frightening for them and also initially alarming for me. Many of these clients had episodes of choking, strong tremors, pressure headaches, pains in various parts of their bodies, and occasional nausea. This was accompanied by a dismal triad of emotions: fear of death, of insanity, and of never coming back from this nightmarish world. The pulse was often significantly accelerated, and sometimes bruises and various color changes spontaneously appeared in my patients' faces without any apparent physical cause. I was aware that there was not a good way to stop an LSD experience, which was taking the form of a bad trip. Administering tranquilizers in the middle of a terrifying session would just freeze the distressing experience and prevent its positive resolution. So I provided support and encouragement for my patients as they were going through these challenging experiences. I discovered that many of them experienced a positive breakthrough, which took the form of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth. At this time, I also scheduled my own LSD sessions, experimenting with higher dosages. My patients reported that in these sessions, they relived their own biological birth. I was able to confirm this in my personal experiences. There was no doubt in my mind that what we were experiencing were authentic and convincing memories of all of the stages of our birth, with all the emotions and physical sensations. I was even able to distinguish four experiential patterns related to the consecutive stages of childbirth and called them basic perinatal matrices, BPM 1 through 4. BPM 1 is related to the advanced stage of pregnancy, before the onset of the delivery. BPM-2 portrays the stage of pregnancy when the uterus is contracted, but the cervix is not yet open. And BPM-3 reflects the propulsion through the birth canal after the cervix is fully dilated. BPM-4 features the experience of birth, emerging from the birth canal and having the umbilical cord cut. I will be returning to this important concept repeatedly in various sections of this encyclopedia. The discovery of the existence of the memory of birth in the unconscious and its paramount implications for psychology came as a big surprise to me and represented the first major intellectual challenge that I encountered in my psychedelic research. In medical school, I had been taught that the fetus and the newborn are not yet conscious. They are not able to experience pain, and their immature brain is not capable of forming the memory of birth. Until as recently as the 1980s, physicians assumed that infants did not have fully developed pain receptors. They believed that the infant's responses to physical insults were merely muscular reactions, and their screaming was dismissed as just a reflex. Medical procedures, from circumcision to heart surgeries, were routinely conducted without anesthesia. There is actually a personal reason why accepting the existence of birth memory was particularly difficult for me. As a second-year medical student, I attended a lecture on memory by Professor William Laufberger, a Czech physiologist who had developed one of the first artificial chess players. He had also become world famous for achieving maturation in axolotls, Mexican salamanders, Ambystoma mexicanum, by giving them thyroid hormones. During the discussion period, I asked Professor Laufberger how far back human memory can reach, and if it is possible to remember birth. He laughed, gave me a scathing look, like I was an absolute idiot, and with great certainty and authority ridiculed me for my question. Of course not. The cortex of the newborn is not myelinized. Eventually, under the impact of numerous observations in my client's sessions as well as my own, I was able to accept the existence of the birth memory as an unquestionable clinical fact, and left it up to the brain researchers to find where this memory might be recorded. As my research continued, much more formidable challenges emerged. On the perinatal level, the fetal memories were often accompanied or alternated with scenes described in spiritual scriptures and historical books, past life experiences, visions of mythological beings, and visits to archetypal realms. In some of the advanced sessions of the series, the transpersonal motifs dominated the experience and the fetal elements were missing. My initial tendency was to see the historical and mythological experiences as derivatives of the birth memories, for which I could see a solid material basis, the highly developed brain of the newborn. The myelinization argument seemed at this point absurd and irrelevant. My attitude to these observations was similar to Otto Rank's tendency to interpret the archetypal, terrible mother goddesses, such as Medusa, Hecate, or Kali, as images inspired by the trauma of birth. I initially thought that I had discovered a logical explanation for the fact that the belief in heaven, paradise, hell and purgatory is so universal in the great religions of the world, and in the mythology and creeds of ancient and native cultures. The blissful experience of the undisturbed prenatal existence, without the concept of linear time, BPM-1, seemed to be a perfect template for the concepts of paradise and heaven. The transition from BPM-1 to BPM-2 for paradise lost, and the extreme emotional and physical suffering without end in BPM-2 for hell. Extreme Suffering with Hope and Perspective of a Better Future, BPM3, corresponded with the descriptions of purgatory and the emergence into numinous bright light, and psycho-spiritual death and rebirth of BPM4 had all the features of divine epiphany as it is reported in the scriptures of various religions. The existence of perinatal matrices also seemed to offer new revolutionary insights into a variety of other areas which were previously inadequately understood by Freudian psychoanalysis and other schools of depth psychology, with the models limited to postnatal biography and the individual unconscious. Salient examples are emotional and psychosomatic disorders, the ritual and spiritual history of humanity, the psychology and psychopathology of art, and the unbridled violence and insatiable greed of the human species, which leads to wars, bloody revolutions, concentration camps, and genocide. We will explore these fascinating topics in future sections of this encyclopedia. However, as I continued my research, I became convinced about the independent existence of a yet deeper domain of the human unconscious psyche that I called transpersonal. It involved authentic identification with the consciousness of other people, groups of people, animals of different species, and even plants. Other types of transpersonal experiences involved ancestral, collective, karmic, and phylogenetic memories, as well as sequences from the mythologies of various cultures, even those of which my clients and I had no previous intellectual knowledge. When I was making these observations, Czechoslovakia was controlled by the Soviet Union. We were unable to buy books from the West, and even our access to books in public libraries was censored and limited. Psychoanalytic literature was on the list of libri prohibiti. It was kept in separate compartments and available only for members of the Communist Party, writing critical books and articles about psychoanalysis. In 1967, when I immigrated to the United States, I was able to receive independent confirmation of many of my findings when I was able to read the works of C.G. Jung and became acquainted with his concept of the collective unconscious and its historical and archetypal domains. Jung's deepest and most convincing new insights came from spontaneous holotropic experiences that he had during his psycho-spiritual crisis, spiritual emergency. Mine from my high-dose LSD sessions. The final and most radical shift in my thinking about psychedelic experiences and other types of holotropic experiences came from more than 40 years of cooperation with my close friend and colleague, Richard Tarnas, which led to the discovery of astonishing correlations between the archetypal content and timing of holotropic states of consciousness and planetary transits, both collective and personal. We have been discussing these findings in our joint classes at the California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS, in San Francisco, in our seminars in the United States and Europe, and in telecourses. According to my present understanding, when we are in a holotropic state, induced either by psychedelic substances, powerful non-pharmacological means, such as holotropic breathwork, or occurring spontaneously, we tune experientially into the archetypal fields of the planets transiting our natal chart. The content of our session will then consist of a selection of biographical memories, fetal memories of one of the BPMs, and transpersonal experiences that have the archetypal qualities associated with the transiting planets. The depth of the unconscious material manifesting in the session will then depend on the archetypal power of the transit, the method that triggered the experience, the type of substance and its dose, if it is a psychedelic session, and previous experience of the subject with holotropic states. In the following section, I will describe and discuss the extended cartography of the psyche as it emerged from my work with holotropic states of consciousness, psychedelic psychotherapy, holotropic breathwork, and work with individuals experiencing spiritual emergency. From Freud to cosmic consciousness. Traditional psychiatrists and psychologists use a model of the human psyche that is limited to postnatal biography and to the individual unconscious described by Sigmund Freud. According to Freud, the newborn is a tabula rasa, clean slate. Nothing that precedes birth is of interest for psychologists, including the birth process itself. Who we become is determined by an interplay between biological instincts and influences that have shaped our life since we came into this world. The quality of nursing, the nature of toilet training, various psychosexual traumas, development of the superego, our reaction to the Oedipal triangle, and conflicts and traumatic events in later life. The Freudian individual unconscious is a derivative of our postnatal history, a repository of what we have forgotten, rejected as unacceptable, and repressed. This underworld of the psyche, the id, as Freud called it, is a realm dominated by primitive instinctual forces. Many aspects of psychoanalysis have been subjected to severe criticism by following generations and rejected or modified. But Freud's idea that psychological history begins after we are born has withstood the test of time and has been integrated into mainstream thinking. To describe the relationship between the conscious psyche and the unconscious, Freud used his famous image of the submerged iceberg. In this simile, what was assumed to be the totality of the psyche was only a small part of it, like the portion of the iceberg showing above the surface of the water. Psychoanalysis discovered that a much larger part of the psyche, comparable to the submerged part of the iceberg, is unconscious and, unbeknownst to us, governs our thought processes and behavior. Later contributions to depth psychology added the development of object relationships and interpersonal dynamics in the nuclear family as etiological factors, but maintain the exclusive emphasis on postnatal life, just like Freudian psychoanalysis. Even with these additions and modifications, this model proves to be painfully inadequate when we work with holotropic states of consciousness, whether induced by psychedelics and various non-drug means, or those occurring spontaneously. To account for all the phenomena occurring in these states, we must drastically revise our understanding of the dimensions of the human psyche. In the early years of my psychedelic research, I sketched a vastly expanded cartography of the psyche that seems to meet this challenge. This map contains, beside the usual biographical level, two transbiographical realms: the perinatal domain, related to the trauma of biological birth, and the transpersonal domain, which accounts for such phenomena as experiential identification with other people, animals, plants, and other aspects of nature. The transpersonal realm is also the source of ancestral, racial, phylogenetic, and karmic memories, as well as visions of archetypal beings and visits to mythological regions. The ultimate experiences in this category are an identification with the universal mind and with the supracosmic and metacosmic void. Perinatal and transpersonal phenomena have been described throughout the ages in the religious, mystical, and occult literature of various parts of the world. Freud's view of the human mind, the mental iceberg. Freud's simile of the iceberg, what we considered to be the psyche is just a small fraction of it, comparable to the tip of the iceberg that shows above the water's surface. Psychoanalysis discovered a vast domain of the psyche that is unconscious, like the submerged part of the iceberg. At the conscious level, we have thoughts and perceptions. At the subconscious level, we have memories and stored knowledge. And at the unconscious level, we have fears, violent motives, unacceptable sexual desires, irrational wishes, immoral urges, shameful experiences, and selfish needs. In view of the observations from holotropic states of consciousness, we can expand Freud's simile of the iceberg. The parts of the psyche discovered and described by classical psychoanalysis represent, at best, still only the tip of the iceberg. Modern consciousness research revealed vast regions of the unconscious that, like the submerged parts of the iceberg, escaped the attention of Freud and his disciples, with the exception of Otto Rank and C.G. Jung. Joseph Campbell, with his incisive Irish humor, described the situation very concisely. Freud was fishing while sitting on a whale. Postnatal biography and the individual unconscious. The biographical domain of the psyche consists of our memories from infancy, childhood, and later life. This part of the psyche does not require much discussion, since it is well known from traditional psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. As a matter of fact, the image of the psyche used in academic circles is limited exclusively to this domain and to the individual unconscious. However, the description of the biographical level of the psyche in the new cartography is not identical with the traditional one. The work with the biographical level of the psyche using holotropic states of consciousness differs from exclusively verbal psychotherapy in several important ways. 1. In holotropic states, unlike in verbal therapy, one does not just remember emotionally significant events or reconstruct them indirectly from the analysis of dreams, neurotic symptoms, slips of the tongue, or from transference distortions. One experiences the original emotions, physical sensations, and even sensory perceptions in full age regression. That means that during the reliving of an important trauma from infancy or childhood, one actually has the body image, the naive perception of the world, sensations, and emotions corresponding to the age he or she was at that time. The authenticity of this regression is also evident from the fact that the wrinkles in the faces of these people temporarily disappear, giving them an infantile expression, and their postures, gestures, and behavior become childlike. They might hypersalivate, suck their fingers, or even show the sucking reflex and Babinski's reflex, fanning of the toes when the side of the sole is scratched by a pin. I've heard from men that when they were regressed and went to the bathroom to urinate, they felt that their penis had shrunk to the size of that of a little boy. In the same vein, women reported that during regression, they felt that their breasts disappeared from their body image. 2. The second difference between working on the biographical material, using a holotropic state of consciousness, and doing it with verbal psychotherapy is that it reveals the psychotraumatic impact of physical traumas and makes it possible to heal them. It should be obvious that physical suffering is also a psychotrauma, but it is not acknowledged and discussed in handbooks of psychology and psychotherapy. The only other approach that recognizes the powerful psychotraumatic impact of physical traumas is Ron Hubbard's Dianetics, Scientology. Scientologists use a process of exploration and therapy called auditing, during which the psychological intensity of emotions, and thus the significance of traumas, is assessed objectively by galvanometers measuring skin resistance. Hubbard referred to imprints of physical traumatizations as engrams and saw them as primary sources of emotional problems. In his terminology, the usual psychological traumas are called secondaries. They borrow their emotional power from their associations with engrams. Scientology recognizes not only the role of physical traumas in postnatal life, but also the impact of somatic traumatization during birth and in past lives. Unfortunately, the abuse of Scientological knowledge for the unethical pursuit of power and money by the Church of Scientology and Hubbard's wild fantasies about the Galactic Federation, the role of extraterrestrials on our planet, clears and operating thetans discredited his important theoretical contributions. As I mentioned earlier, until as recently as the 1980s, the psychotraumatic impact of pain was not acknowledged by the medical profession. This was the case not only for memories of painful events, but also for current injuries in infants. Anesthesia was not used in infants during normally painful interventions, and circumcision is even today conducted in many places without anesthesia. For people with common sense, the 2015 report from Oxford University, entitled British Scientists Prove That Newborns Experience Pain, sounded almost like a joke. One could expect that the next research project would be Scientists Prove That Dogs and Cats Experience Pain. The reason for the failure to recognize that physical insults are psychotraumas might be the fact that remembering and mentioning physical traumas in verbal psychotherapy is not associated with the experience of pain or other physical signs. In experiential therapy, the memory of pain is relived in its full intensity, even if its source is surgical intervention conducted under general anesthesia. Many people undergoing psychedelic or holotropic therapy relive experiences of near drowning, operations, accidents, and discomfort during childhood diseases. Of particular importance seem to be memories of events associated with suffocation, such as diphtheria, whooping cough, strangling, or aspiration of a foreign object. This material emerges quite spontaneously and without any programming. As it surfaces, we realize that these physical traumas have a strong psychotraumatic impact, and that they play a significant role in the psychogenesis of emotional and psychosomatic problems. A history of physical traumas can regularly be found in clients suffering from asthma, migraine headaches, psychosomatic pains, panic anxiety attacks, phobias, sadomasochistic tendencies, or depression and suicidal tendencies. Reliving traumatic memories of this kind and their integration can have far-reaching therapeutic consequences. In my experience, psychosomatic symptoms and disorders can always be traced back to situations involving physical assaults or traumas. This fact contrasts sharply with the position of academic psychiatry and psychology, which do not recognize the psychotraumatic impact of physical traumas. It also seriously questions the explanations of psychosomatic disorders as expressions of psychological problems and conflicts in body language. For example, pain in the shoulders has been interpreted as symbolizing the patient's feelings that he or she carries too much responsibility. Pain in the stomach and nausea as meaning that the client is not able to stomach something. And psychogenic asthma as dramatizing the cry for the mother. The psychotraumatic impact of physical pain and the resolution of this trauma can be illustrated by the story of Katya, a 49-year-old psychiatric nurse participating in our training for holotropic breathwork facilitators. Before she enrolled in the training, Katya had suffered from intense chronic back pain and episodes of depression. In her breathwork sessions, she was able to trace back her symptoms to a traumatic experience in early childhood, immobilization in a cast lasting many weeks, and resolve the armoring. Here is Katya's report in her own words. Intense breathing at the beginning of the session made me feel that my body was blocked and frozen in a supine position. I tried desperately to turn on my belly, but was not able to do so. I experienced myself as a helpless turtle, turned on her back, unable to escape her dangerous predicament. I began to cry for not being able to change my position, because it seemed that my life depended on it. I noticed that this turtle had on her belly the image of a child needing nourishment, and I felt that there was some connection between this experience and my own inner child. I kept crying for a long time without consolation. After a long time, something changed, and I felt that this turtle shell had on it the image of a beautiful landscape. Then my experience changed again, and I became a small child who could not change her position and needed help from someone else in order to do it. After some time and with great effort, I finally succeeded to turn on my belly and saw myself in a beautiful landscape, running on the beach and diving and swimming in crystal clear water. I realized that the landscape in which I found myself was the same as the one that was depicted on the turtle's shell. I felt free and enjoyed the scent of the flowers, the rushing cascades, and the air filled with the fragrance of the pines. I felt old like the earth and young like the eternal puppy, a playful reference to the Jungian archetype of Puella Eterna. I saw a small pond and I went to drink. As I did, I felt deeply relaxed, and the sense of health and great well-being filled my body and my mind. Sometime later, I shared this experience with my mother, and she told me that when I was a year old, my pediatrician decided that I had to be put in a cast with my legs apart because of an imperfect structure of my hip joints. I had to stay immobilized for 40 days. The second example is from psycholytic therapy with LSD that I conducted at the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague. The name psycholytic refers to serial administrations of medium dosages of the substance. Milan was a 36-year-old architect who enrolled in the LSD program with the diagnosis of psychogenic asthma after unsuccessful conventional therapy. A series of LSD sessions revealed a major multi-level memory constellation underlying this disorder. The most superficial layer of this system was a memory of near drowning at the age of 7 that brought Milan close to death. A deeper layer of the same system was constituted by memories of being repeatedly choked and smothered by his 2 years older brother at the age of around 4 and 5. On an even deeper layer were memories of severe whooping cough at the age of 2, with episodes of choking. These biographical layers of this memory constellation were linked to an episode of perinatal crisis when his shoulder got stuck behind the pubic bone of his mother. The deepest layer of this complex system was transpersonal. It was what he identified as a past life experience of death on the gallows. It was a punishment for participating in a rebellion against a British king in medieval times. Milan relived all the above experiences in his serial LSD sessions. It was associated with anxiety, strong coughing, flailing around, and intense tremors. In the course of his therapy, his clinical condition oscillated, but a major relief of his symptoms did not occur until his experience of death in the past life in England. 3. The story of Milan, besides showing the psychotraumatic effect of physical traumas, illustrated another important feature of the biographical, recollective level of the psyche. The work with holotropic states has shown that emotionally relevant memories are not stored in the unconscious as a mosaic of isolated imprints, but in the form of complex dynamic constellations. I have coined for these memory aggregates the name COEX systems, which is short for Systems of Condensed Experience. This concept is of such theoretical and practical importance that it deserves special discussion. A COEX system consists of emotionally charged memories from different periods of our life that resemble each other in the quality of emotions or physical sensations that they share. Each COEX has a basic theme that permeates all its layers and represents their common denominator. The individual layers then contain variations on this basic theme that occurred at different periods of the person's life. The unconscious of a particular individual can contain several major COEX constellations. Their number, intensity, and the nature of the central themes varies considerably person to person. The layers of a particular system can, for example, contain all the major memories of humiliating, degrading, and shaming experiences that have damaged our self-esteem. In another COEX system, the common denominator can be anxiety experienced in various shocking and terrifying situations, or claustrophobic and suffocating feelings evoked by oppressive and confining circumstances. Rejection and emotional deprivation, damaging the ability to trust men, women, or people in general, is another common motif. Situations that have generated profound feelings of guilt and a sense of failure, events that have resulted in a conviction that sex is dangerous or disgusting, and encounters with aggression and violence can be added to the above list as characteristic examples. Particularly important are COEX systems that contain memories of encounters with situations endangering life, health, and the integrity of the body. This could leave the impression that COEX systems always contain painful and traumatic memories. However, it is the intensity of the experience and its emotional relevance that determines whether a memory will be included into a COEX, not its unpleasant nature. In addition to negative constellations, there are also those that comprise memories of very pleasant or even ecstatic events, memories of loving and fulfilling relationships, episodes of harmony in the family, stays in beautiful natural settings, major accomplishments and achievements, and so on. COEX systems involving painful emotions and unpleasant physical feelings are, however, more common than the positive ones. This concept emerged from psychotherapy with clients suffering from serious forms of psychopathology, where the work on traumatic aspects of life plays a very important role. This accounts for the fact that constellations involving painful experiences receive much more attention. The spectrum of negative COEX systems is also considerably richer and more variegated than that of the positive ones. As Joseph Campbell pointed out, the misery in our life can have many different forms, while happiness depends on the fulfillment of a few basic conditions. However, a general discussion requires emphasizing that the COEX dynamics is not limited to constellations of traumatic memories. In the early stages of my psychedelic research, when I first discovered the existence of COEX systems, I described them as principles governing the dynamics of the biographical level of the unconscious. At that time, My understanding of psychology was based on a very narrow biographical model of the psyche inherited from teachers, particularly my Freudian analyst. It was also true that, in the initial psychedelic sessions of a therapeutic series, especially when lower dosages, 15 to 200 micrograms, were used, the biographical material often dominated the picture. This stage proved to be very important for the exploration of various layers of the psyche and their relationship to the dynamics of the symptoms, deemed chemoarchaeology, or the onion peeling of the unconscious, as some of my clients called it. Since my patients were allowed to keep their eyes open for significant parts of their sessions, I also gained important insights into the dynamics of their optical illusions and visions. I describe these findings in some detail in my book, Realms of the Human Unconscious. I found out that keeping the eyes open was not the most effective therapeutic strategy, but it was essential for the discovery of the coax systems and their influence on the phenomenology of the psychedelic experiences. In the course of this research, it became clear to me that the coax systems were not limited to the biographical level, but reached much deeper into the unconscious. In my present understanding, each of the coax constellations seems to be superimposed over and anchored in a particular aspect of the birth process, a basic perinatal matrix, or BPM. The experience of biological birth is so complex and rich in emotions and physical sensations that it contains in a prototypical form the elementary themes of most conceivable coax systems. However, a typical coax system reaches even further, and its deepest roots consist of various forms of transpersonal phenomena, such as ancestral, collective, and karmic memories, Jungian archetypes, conscious identification with various animals, phylogenetic memories, and others. I now see the coax systems as general organizing principles of the human psyche. During our joint research, now extending over a period of more than 40 years, Richard Tarnas and I discovered that the phenomenology of holotropic states in general, and of the coax systems in particular, can best be understood through the lens of archetypal dynamics. As we will see at a later date, that makes archetypal astrology what I call the Rosetta Stone of consciousness research. The concept of the coax system has some similarity to C.G. Jung's ideas about psychological complexes and Hans-Carl Luner's notion of transphenomenal dynamic systems, T-DISTs, but it has many features that differentiate it from both of them. Before continuing the discussion about coax systems, I would like to briefly outline the similarities and differences between these three concepts. C.G. Jung's concept of complex emerged from his work with the association experiment. He inferred it on the basis of disturbances of the association process, prolonged reaction time, and gaps or falsification of memory during repetition of the experiment. Jung described the complex as a mass of memories and other psychological content that share a definite feeling tone, irritation, fear, anger, etc. Every complex has a nuclear element, a vehicle of meaning, and a number of associations stemming from personal experience. Jung pointed out the resemblance of complexes with Richard Wagner's use of leitmotifs, distinct musical themes characterizing dramatis personae, animals, objects, and situations. The leitmotifs are the feeling tones of our complexes. Our actions and moods are modulations of the leitmotifs. At the bottom of each complex, Jung found a universal governing principle, or an archetype. For Jung, this complex was comprised of biographical and archetypal material. He did not include in it any perinatal elements, since he did not believe that biological birth was of any relevance for psychology. Jung assigned to complexes the central role in depth psychology. Complexes, not the dreams as Freud thought, were for him the via regia to the unconscious. In humans, complexes manifest as involuntary fantasy images, attitudes, and actions that are specific for them. They can be found everywhere and at all epochs. They are numinous and can be detected above all in the realm of religious ideas. According to Jung, complexes have not only an obsessive, but often possessive character. Everybody knows nowadays that people have complexes. What is not so well known, though far more important theoretically, is that complexes can have us. Complexes behave like sabotaging imps and give rise to all sorts of annoying, ridiculous, and revealing actions. They are behind the phenomena that Freud called psychopathology of everyday life, slips of the tongue and falsifications of memory and judgment. Intellectual knowledge of a complex is useless. Its harmful action will continue until we discharge it. Then it rises into consciousness and can be assimilated. Hans Carl Luner's concept of the transphenomenal dynamic systems, T-DISTs, came from his work with the serial administration of low doses of psychedelics. My concept of coex systems was formulated and described independently from Luner's T-DISTs. At that time in Prague, we could not get hard currency to buy foreign literature and did not have contact with researchers from the West. In his book Die Experimentelle Psychose, Luner described T-DISTs as layered constellations of emotionally charged memories from different periods of postnatal life, infancy, childhood, and adulthood. Luner developed this concept specifically to explain the phenomenology of LSD sessions. He did not try to apply it to other areas. According to Luner, the T-DISTs determine the nature and content of LSD sessions. The layer of the T-DIST emerging into consciousness influences the individual's thoughts, feelings, behavior, and the elusive transformations of the therapist and environment to the patient. Up to this point, the T-DIST resembles the coex system. But Luner's model is based on Freudian psychoanalysis and is limited to postnatal biography. It does not include the perinatal and transpersonal levels of the psyche. Luner claimed that when all the layers of a T-DIST emerge into consciousness and its emotional charge is dissipated, it loses its power over the individual's behavior and experience of the world. According to my observations, the archetypal field of the coex usually reaches deeper into the psyche, to the perinatal and transpersonal levels. Luner's model of the psyche remained limited to the postnatal biographical level. Having used low doses of LSD, 75 micrograms, he did not discover the perinatal domain of the unconscious and reduced the transpersonal to the infantile. The transcendental equals the primary narcissistic. The coex systems play an important role in our psychological life. They can influence the way we perceive ourselves, other people, and the world, as well as how we feel and act. They are the dynamic forces behind our emotional and psychosomatic symptoms, difficulties in relationships with other people, and irrational behaviors. And whereas Luner's concept of T-DIST does not imply a two-way interaction with the environment, I found that there exists a dynamic interplay between the coex systems and the external world. External events in our life can specifically activate corresponding coex systems, and conversely, active coex systems can determine how we perceive ourselves in the world and make us behave in such a way that we recreate their core themes in our present life. This mechanism can be observed very clearly in experiential work. In holotropic states, the content of the experience, the perception of the environment, and the behavior of the client are determined in general terms by the coex system that dominates the session and, more specifically, by the layer of this system that is momentarily emerging into consciousness. All of the characteristics of coex systems can best be demonstrated by a practical example. I have chosen for this purpose Peter, a 37-year-old tutor who had been intermittently hospitalized and unsuccessfully treated in our department in Prague prior to his psychedelic therapy. At the time we began with the experiential sessions, Peter could hardly function in his everyday life. He was almost constantly obsessed with the idea of finding a man with certain physical characteristics, preferably dressed in black clothes. He wanted to befriend this man and tell him about his urgent desire to be locked in a dark cellar and be exposed to various diabolic physical and mental tortures. Unable to concentrate on anything else, he wandered aimlessly through the city, visiting public parks, lavatories, bars, and railroad stations searching for the right man. He succeeded on several occasions to persuade or bribe various men who met his criteria to promise or do what he asked for. Having a special gift for finding persons with sadistic traits, he was almost killed twice, several times seriously hurt, and once robbed of all his money. On those occasions where he was able to experience what he craved, he was extremely frightened and actually strongly disliked the tortures. In addition to this main problem, Peter suffered from suicidal depression, impotence, and infrequent epileptiform seizures. Reconstructing his history, I found out that his major problems started at the time of his involuntary employment in Germany during World War II. The Nazis used people brought to Germany from occupied territories for work in places threatened by air raids, such as foundries and ammunition factories. They referred to this form of slave labor as Totaleinsetzung. At that time, two SS officers repeatedly forced him at gunpoint to engage in their homosexual practices. When the war was over, Peter realized that these experiences created in him a strong preference for homosexual intercourse experienced in the passive role. This gradually changed into fetishism for black male clothes, and finally into the complex obsessive-compulsive masochistic behavior described above. 15 consecutive psychedelic sessions revealed a very interesting and important coex system underlying his problems. In its most superficial layers were Peter's more recent traumatic experiences with his sadistic partners. On several occasions, the accomplices he recruited actually bound him with ropes, locked him in a cellar without food and water, and tortured him by flagellation and strangulation, according to his wish. One of these men hit him on his head, bound him with a string, and left him lying in a forest after stealing his money. Peter's most dramatic adventure involved a man who claimed he had just the kind of cellar Peter wanted in his cabin in the woods and promised to take him there. When they were traveling by train to this man's weekend house, Peter was struck by his companion's strange-looking bulky backpack. When the latter left the compartment and went to the bathroom, Peter stepped up on the seat and checked the suspicious baggage. He discovered a complete set of murder weapons, including a gun, a large butcher knife, a freshly sharpened hatchet, and a surgical saw used for amputations. Panic-stricken, he jumped out of the moving train and suffered serious injuries. Elements of the above episodes formed the superficial layers of Peter's most important coax system. A deeper layer of the same system contained Peter's memories from the Third Reich. In the sessions where this part of the coax constellation manifested, he relived his experiences with the homosexual SS officers in detail, with all the complicated feelings involved. In addition, he relived several other traumatic memories from World War II and dealt with the entire oppressive atmosphere of this period. He had visions of pompous Nazi military parades and rallies, banners with swastikas, ominous giant eagle emblems, scenes from concentration camps, and many others. Then came layers related to Peter's childhood, particularly those involving punishment by his parents. His alcoholic father was often violent when he was drunk and used to beat him with a large leather strap. His mother's favorite method of punishing him was to lock him into a dark cellar without food for long periods of time. Peter recalled that throughout his childhood, she always wore black dresses. He did not remember her ever wearing anything else. At this point, he realized that one of the roots of his obsession seemed to be craving suffering that would combine elements of punishment inflicted on him by his parents. However, that was not the whole story. As we continued with the sessions, the process deepened, and Peter confronted the trauma of his birth with all its biological brutality. This situation had all the elements that he expected from the sadistic treatment he was so desperately trying to receive: dark and closed space, confinement and restriction of physical movement, and exposure to extreme physical and emotional tortures. Reliving the trauma of his birth finally resolved his difficult symptoms to such an extent that he could once again function in life. In a holotropic state, when a coax system is emerging into consciousness, it assumes a governing function and determines the nature and content of the experience. Our perceptions of ourselves and of the human and physical environment are distorted and elusively transformed in correspondence with the basic motif of the emerging coax constellation and with the specific features of its individual layers. This mechanism can be illustrated by describing the dynamics of Peter's holotropic process. When Peter was working through the most superficial layers of the described coax system, he saw me transformed into his past sadistic partners, or into figures symbolizing aggression, such as a butcher, murderer, medieval executioner, inquisitor, or cowboy with a lasso. He perceived my fountain pen as an oriental dagger and expected to be attacked with it. When he saw on the table a knife with a staghorn handle used for opening envelopes, he immediately saw me changing into a violent-looking forester. On several occasions, he asked to be tortured and wanted to suffer for the doctor by withholding urination. During this period, the treatment room and the view from the window were elusively transformed into various settings where Peter's adventures with his sadistic partners took place. When the older layer from World War II was the focus of his experience, Peter saw me transformed into Hitler and other Nazi leaders, a concentration camp commander, SS member, and Gestapo officer. Instead of ordinary noises outside the treatment room, he heard ominous sounds of parading soldiers' boots, music from the Nazi rallies, and parades by the Brandenburg Gate and the national anthem of Nazi Germany. The treatment room was successively transformed into a room in the Reichstag, with eagle emblems and swastikas, a barrack in a concentration camp, a jail with heavy bars in the window, and even a death row. When the core experiences from childhood were emerging in these sessions, Peter perceived me as punishing parental figures. At this time, he tended to display toward me various anachronistic behavior patterns characteristic of his relationship with his father and mother. The treatment room was changing into various parts of his home setting in childhood, particularly into the dark cellar in which he was repeatedly locked up by his mother. The mechanism described above has its dynamic counterpart, the tendency of external stimuli to activate corresponding coex systems of persons in holotropic states, and to facilitate the emergence of the content of these systems into consciousness. This happens in those instances where specific external influences, such as elements of the physical setting, interpersonal environment, or therapeutic situation, bear a resemblance to the original traumatic scenes or contain identical components. This seems to be the key for understanding the extraordinary significance of set and setting for the holotropic experience. A sequence from one of Peter's LSD sessions illustrates the activation of a coex system by specific external stimuli accidentally introduced into the therapeutic situations. One of the important core experiences that Peter uncovered in his LSD therapy was a memory of being locked by his mother into a dark cellar and denied food while the other members of the family were eating. The reliving of this memory was triggered quite unexpectedly by the angry barking of a dog that ran by the open window of the treatment room. The analysis of this event showed an interesting relationship between the external stimulus and the activated memory. Peter recalled that the cellar his mother used for punishment had a small window overlooking the neighbor's courtyard. The neighbor's German shepherd, chained to his doghouse, used to bark almost incessantly on the occasions when Peter was confined in the cellar. In holotropic states, people often manifest seemingly inappropriate and highly exaggerated reactions to various environmental stimuli. Such overreacting is specific and selective, and can usually be understood in terms of the dynamics of the governing coex systems. Thus, patients are particularly sensitive to what they consider uninterested, cold, and professional treatment when they are under the influence of memory constellations that involve emotional deprivation, rejection, or neglect by their parents or other relevant figures in their childhood.